As a writer of fiction, I depend on my editor. For instance, in my first novel, I tied up all the loose ends with an epilogue that was set a century after the main story ends. And my brilliant book editor, thank God, convinced me that it had to go, and it did. But these days, the talk around book publishing is about how few books are really edited at all. Sarah Nelson has been observing the publishing world for a long time as the book industry editor of Inside.com and now as the books editor of Glamour magazine. Here's her take on the state of the art in book editing today.
Ask people outside the cloistered world of book publishing what exactly an editor does, and they'll shrug. Editors fix spelling and punctuation, don't they? Ask closer observers of that world, and they'll shrug too, but for a different reason. Editors used to talk with writers about prose and pace and plot. They used to spend weeks with a manuscript cutting and pruning and restructuring. But there's no such animal, not anymore. In publishing's golden age, roughly the first half of the last century, the written word was sacrosanct, and its patron saint was Maxwell Perkins. Perkins worked with F. Scott Fitzgerald, Ernest Hemingway, and Thomas Wolfe. He called himself a handmaiden to authors, but he was a lot more than that. He regularly thought up titles and invented plots. He also was reportedly not above running a manuscript through his own typewriter. Even in his own time, Perkins was a rare bird. They're even rarer now. There are many times more books published today, fewer editors, and far fewer readers. Publishing houses are owned by entertainment conglomerates increasingly focused on the bottom line. Books are product, writers are talent, and editors spend their weeks writing marketing and catalog copy and negotiating for projects for the future. Most of an editor's work, in other words, is on getting the book in and getting it out. If anybody edits the old-fashioned way, it's those who toil at magazines. Have you ever noticed that Stephen King's articles in The New Yorker read better than just about any of his best-selling books? I rest my case. Just one thing. Don't tell a book editor he doesn't edit. Most of them will get defensive. I do so work with text, they'll say. I do too. Some even dare scorn the hallowed Perkins overhaul approach. A friend of mine at Random House said, I wonder why you'd want to acquire a book by a writer who isn't a good enough writer to do most of the work by him or herself. The few editors who do edit generally won't talk about it. Take Nan Talese. She is widely credited with reorganizing and distilling Pat Conroy's thousands of pages of scribbles into bestsellers like Prince of Tides. She's of the old school. She won't come on a radio show and talk about, say, Ian McEwan, whose Atonement is her latest bestseller. I know, I asked her. She also won't openly criticize other editors, but if you push, she'll acknowledge that there are many, many books that get to the stores before they're ready. Why? Maybe, one, because conglomerates insist that books get listed in the catalogs and on the corporate bottom line, sometimes even before they've been submitted. This forces editors to push through books that aren't quite finished. Maybe, two, they suffer the lack of the apprentice system. Talese worked for 10 years at the feet of senior Random House editors. Today, an editor will quit after 2 years without a promotion. But Talese says it's not that younger editors don't try to edit. In her Best Finishing School Whisper, she tells me that the problem is that most young editors don't see that anything's wrong. It's not that they're lazy. Maybe they're just not good. Still, to say that every editor and every book from the Golden Age was of a quality superior to those from our own more tarnished one is about as misguided as believing that the glory days of radio produced only great shows. For every Maxwell Perkins and Nan Talese, there have been at least as many forgettable editors who shepherded equally forgettable books. Any editing that gets done these days is getting done after the fact, and usually by lawyers. Look at the works of Doris Kearns Goodwin and Stephen Ambrose, and that new prison memoir, You've Got Nothing Coming, and the Wall Street expose of hedge fund operator James Cramer. They all pass through editors and are only now being questioned. It's never been easy to define the job of editor. Part shrink, part mother, part marriage counselor, part lawyer, not to mention conceptualizer and line fixer. But the one thing an editor always needs is a willing author. Even the brilliant Thomas Wolfe let Perkins take a hacksaw to You Can't Go Home Again because he knew Perkins would make it better. An author I know, Susan Isaacs, is not so generous. She wrote the bestseller Shining Through, along with several other books, for HarperCollins, and has recently jumped to Scribner, where she doesn't want or expect any more intrusive editing than she got before. She told me, I don't want anyone sticking in his or her creatures or telling me, while the work is in progress, that my meteorological imagery sucks the big one. For some editors, their very jobs depend on knowing when to keep silent. There's a famous and maybe apocryphal story about the author Graham Greene. Apparently, Green's editor had the temerity to suggest changing a book title. What did Green think? Here's what his cable back to the pesky editor said. Easier to change publisher than title.
Sarah Nelson is an editor, and she's now writing a book called 52 Weeks, 52 Books, Diary of a Reader. I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360 today with the film editor, Dodie Dorn, and we're talking about all kinds of editing. Dodie, I wondered how you, what your reaction to that story was, because clearly a book editor in film terms is sort of like a combination film editor and studio executive. It's a much sort of broader mandate.
Well, obviously, you're expected to do that work, and if you don't do it, then you're, not doing the job. I like that Nan Talese said she won't talk about her work, because that's another one of those things. You don't really talk a lot about what you're doing in the editing room with the director or with the film. And the idea of being a handmaiden, shrink, mother, lawyer, all of those things definitely come into play as a film editor. And there's a certain kind of confidence that you have with the director, that you're not meant to trumpet what was his idea, what was your idea, and that sort of thing. It is a real true collaboration, and the person that's meant to be getting the credit, in fact, is the director, not the editor.
I guess you were born to be an editor, it sounds like. It sounds like you have the ideal temperament.
Right. Well, I had to work at it, by the way, because the very first job I edited, actually not the first, the second one, I think I did get my ego was definitely laid out on the line and was jumped up and down and trampled on. And then after that, I decided, you know, that wasn't very much fun. How about if I try it this way? And ever since then, it's been, everything has gone much more smoothly.
So you sort of a Zen transformation of yourself.
Completely. And I say this in every meeting that I meet with a director, I'm going to have thousands and thousands of ideas. And if you want somebody with lots and lots of ideas, that's me, but I don't care if you take two or three or four of them, but I have to feel free to express the ideas. And that's what I say when I go into a meeting. Because if I don't feel free to at least express them, then I die a little bit, or a lot.